Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline and I play stupid games and win stupid prizes. Joining me is a woman who is still trying to get her scarf back from Maggie Gyllenhaal, Marisa Bate.
Hello there, Caroline.
Marisa Bate, this is one of the most requested Sentimental Garbage episodes of all time.
Terrifying. I mean, the force of Taylor and the Swifties is not to be underestimated. And I almost didn't say yes because I thought, how could I speak for Swifties?
For kind of a whole, like maybe two generations of women.
Yeah, and the many to come, right?
And the many to come, precisely. Because I think it will be the kind of thing of like, boys will always have an age where they get into Bob Dylan and girls from now on will all have an age where they get into Taylor.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's funny that, I mean, the fans of this show kind of know what it's about. They know it is kind of about a guilty pleasure sort of thing. It is about the stuff that maybe we are ashamed to bring up on a first date or something because of how uncool it might make us look. And it strikes me as funny that like one of the most like decorated artists of our lifetime, like 13 Grammys or something, could still be sort of counted as a bit of a tacky pleasure, you know?
Yeah.
Is that odd to you?
It is and it isn't, right? I mean, it is incredible when you think she's now on par in some ways with the Beatles in terms of record breaking or things like that. But yes, I probably still, I don't go out in my Taylor Swift t-shirts. I go
Pearl.
Out, you know, and I feel guilty about that. You know, I've let myself down.
Yes.
But yes, and I. But then on the other hand, you know, as I'm sure we'll talk about, she is this kind of country turned pop star who's been so sweet and nice, in how she's presented herself, and was pretty uncool from day one.
Mm.
So I think, yes, there is this, it's a contradiction, but there is something about her that doesn't have that gravitas of a Madonna or a Rihanna. And it's really interesting to explore why, which I'm...
It's funny because like she does things that if another kind, not even necessarily just a male artist, but if another kind of artist did, you'd be like, well, that's fucking pimp. Do you know what I mean? Like the re-recording of all of her songs. And in some cases, which, you know, because she wants to own the masters, which is pretty punk. And then sort of rewriting some of those songs and, you know, ruining Jake Gyllenhaal's life in the process.
Amen.
That's pretty punk. Like, you know, there's lots of really cool things she's done, but because there's kind of something a bit milquetoast, a bit bland, a bit, oh, so you're a woman with feelings, are you?
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, yeah. And I think she, but I, you know, I also think some of those things have come later.
Yeah.
You know, the bits of Taylor that fans, me as a fan is most proud of have come later. And there's been a kind of awakening in her, hasn't there, I think?
Yes.
And that shift makes her somebody I'm much more proud to, you know, kind of show my allegiance to. Whereas the earlier Taylor, the Taylor the world first met, was just, to me, you know, she'd come out on those late night shows in those little tweed dresses.
Yes, the very fairy princess dresses, singing about fairy princess stories.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it has taken some work to undo that in people's minds. I don't know. This is why I'm worried about being on this podcast, because I'm going to offend so many people.
No.
There isn't something instinctively uncool about her, but that makes me like her, right?
Yes.
Like she's not the world's greatest dancer. She doesn't, you know, people who can like move so naturally are just, in my book, amazingly cool. She's a slightly awkward dancer. You know, when I've seen her live and she does those bits at the piano where she starts talking about being bullied, I have no time for it. I'm like, please keep singing because you could sing to me forever, but please stop talking. Like, there are things in her that I kind of find endearingly uncool. And her kind of coolness has come to me in her kind of growing up. And I think that's fair enough. When I was younger, I think I expected more of her. But actually, I cannot imagine. I mean, I think I'm about 3 or 4 years older than her, 4 or 5, I'm not sure. I cannot imagine those years in the public eye with that level of fame, you know, with all the Kanye stuff, with all that money. So, you know, and all the people around her. I mean, the Netflix documentary was really interesting to me because I think some of her kind of twee niceness was explained by the kind of machine around her. And I think you really saw that in moments when she was trying to persuade her team to allow her to kind of come out against a Republican congresswoman.
Oh, yes, I forgot all about that.
Yeah, and she was kind of talking to her dad and another man and trying to persuade them that she could, that she should sort of let it be known how she feels politically. And eventually she did. And then to me, what was really interesting, the people who supported her in that moment were women. It was her mother and her publicist who's a woman. So that kind of, to me, you know, country music is a whole conversation in itself, and the gender dynamics in there are really fascinating to me. But she definitely played that sweet, the kind of nice, sweet girl who doesn't rock the boat.
Because she grew up in the aftermath of the Dixie Chicks, right?
Absolutely.
Like, they are kind of, apart from, like, you know, Dolly Parton or something, who's so stratospheric, the only icons she would have had to emulate would have been the Dixie Chicks, who are these sort of, like, blonde, pop, country, sort of mainstream radio people who absolutely eviscerated their career by being critical of the war in Iraq. So I can see why she would have been terrified.
Oh, absolutely. They said one thing at a gig.
In Shepherd's Bush.
And then there were, you know, these people burning their records. And that was the message. Like, the message was to, you know, I mean, not stay quiet about all things because she talked halfway through her gigs. But she, you know, to not speak about anything, which for me is the stuff I want to see women talk about. You know, I desperately want to see. Why do I think that's cool? I don't know. I don't know if I think it's cool. I just admire it. And so that era of Taylor, the beginnings of her, were a little mute, a little bland. The clothes were terrible, and I didn't love the music. So I think, so she isn't this kind of, like, she's arrived on the planet Earth, this fully formed kind of goddess who we should all adore. She's grown up, and as she's grown up, to me, she's just flourished in every way because her writing's got better, her singing's got better. She's spoken out about things she believes in. You know, she just gets better and better, which as a fan is a joy.
It really is. It is a real joy to watch someone like Taylor Swift evolve. And because she's of our generation, and she's stuck around. Do you know what I mean? We've really watched it. And it's like this, like, glowing, huge cube of marble that is beautiful to look at, be chipped away by the things that happen to it. And then the sculpture underneath is like, oh, wow. I love this. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's so true. But we've also seen bits when maybe that sculpting went a bit wrong, you know?
Yeah. And that's satisfying in its own way.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, it has been a journey. I think if you're a Taylor fan, I mean, I was a fan from Red onwards. And, you know, it's been years now.
See, this is the thing. Like, I went recently to the Troxy to Swiftageddon, which I don't know if you've been to.
I haven't.
It's a real riot. I think it's like 12 quid a ticket. And it's just, you know, 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. just Taylor Swift songs.
Wow.
And me and my brother and two friends went. And my brother's an enormous Swift fan. So he's like really looking forward to this to this episode. But I couldn't believe that I was in this place for hours and hours and hours. And the songs didn't repeat once. And there was no, like, oh, the DJ is doing a funny remix of this song or whatever. It was just the songs.
Wow.
And they were all great. You could dance to all of them. Or you could do sort of white girl clutching your chest, closing your eyes and singing up to the ceiling sort of dancing.
Yeah,
which I also love. And like, I just kept saying, she's our age.
Oh, yeah.
How can someone our age have this many bangers? I mean, that alone.
It's phenomenal. I mean, there aren't many artists who could fill a club just by with someone pressing like play.
Literally, yeah. There were some confetti cannons and some sort of placards and things. But like, other than that, there was really no bells and whistles.
She is a phenomenon. I think you used that word to me when we were talking over email. She is. And she's prolific. And I mean, that kind of, I think, marks her as a... So many of the greats I really admire, like people like Bruce Springsteen, they're prolific. Mm. They write so many songs. I mean, the new Red Taylor's version, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot, so much new material on there.
Songs. I mean, yeah, she's... It's almost... You imagine it's something she can't help but do. Yeah. You know, and it's how she understands the experience of living is through putting it in a song, which she, you know, I think you do hear her life through her songs. But yeah, she's a phenomena. And I think it's so interesting, kind of what you said at first. It's so easy to forget, you know, one of the richest women in America.
Yeah.
Because she still kind of does that kind of like, oh, I'm just little Taylor here with my cats, you know, like... Just here and here of my here baking with my best friend. You know, I'm just like you.
Yes.
And there's the, you know, and I think she kind of shies away. She doesn't do so much. She doesn't present herself very often as this kind of, you know, international global megastar.
Yeah, it's not the Beyonce thing where Beyonce has this thing where she projects, I'm not like you, I am an untouchable god, and find inspiration in my human godliness, which I really respect. And which is why Beyonce has to go away for years at a time, right?
Yes.
Because if she was being a god on earth all the time, we would be knackered by it.
Yeah. It's so true. Whereas, you know, Taylor is literally like, here's my diary.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Here, like, my fans, you know, her love affair with her fans, which I think is why the Swifties are the way they are. And that is something I have never got into. You know, I like to think of like my relationship with Taylor is like, if I have the faith, I don't have the religion, you know, like it's very private. And yeah. I had a
That's a good way of putting it.
I tried to start a group, a WhatsApp group with two other friends who are the biggest Swift fans I know. And they actually left our group of three.
Both of them?
Yeah.
So it's just you on your own.
To start another group with like far more committed Easter egg finding.
Oh, I see.
Fans.
That I find very boring, actually.
Yeah. Do you?
No, see, I think I'm similar to you in that I love to love things passionately and find great meaning in them and applying them to my own life and feeling it. But finding sort of background details in music videos that relate to something else and like, oh, the number 13 is through, like, that really bores me, because to me it's a form of bird watching and not a form of fandom, you know?
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's the music, you know. It's like my ultimate Taylor experience is walking somewhere on my own with her in my ears. Yeah. And that's it. I really don't care if, you know, three albums ago she hinted that, you know, in 9 days' time, you know, times 15 on the day she was born. You know, like, none of that. So I was kind of, I was rejected from the group. But yeah, it has felt very personal, actually, my relationship with Taylor, which is an insane sentence to say. But actually, if I think back all the years that I've been listening to her, she has been the soundtrack always. Yeah. There has been other soundtracks, but she has always been there.
I'd like to bring you back to, I think it was the year 2016, when you and I were working together. Is it 16 too? I don't know.
We were probably working together in 2016. Yeah.
And my experience with Taylor Swift was, I was a Kanye West fan. So I didn't care, kind of thing. I really just didn't care at all. I sort of saw her as a footnote in the grand narrative of my man Kanye's life.
Do you know what I mean? Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Not that I didn't think that was like, you know, obviously that was a shit thing that happened to her. And a funny way for her to be launched on the sort of international stage. But yeah, that's kind of how I regard it. And I sort of like just wasn't arsed, really. But you were the first Swiftie I ever met, really. You're the first person who was like, no, this is like really means something to me. And this is like quite a big part of, if you want to understand me, your coworker, Marisa Bay, you will have to on some level understand Taylor Swift also. Not that you were in your face about it, but just that you referenced her a lot. You referenced music a lot. Like, I could see that in your own aesthetic, it was like coming through as well. And I always found that very interesting about you, because I always, you know, you're a couple of years older than I am and you were more senior than me in that office. So I was like, it's a very serious lady journalist who just bloody loves Taylor Swift.
That's a nice bio. I will go with that. Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting you kind of say that, because I think I felt that it was a slightly childish, like maybe embarrassing side of me. You know, I'd grown up with my mum and my brother who just kind of relentlessly liked cool music, and I was played cool music and everything was really fucking cool all the time. And that's fine.
If you like that kind of thing.
But it was, there was no room for, apart from ABBA, there was no room for like just loving something that wasn't cool.
No, I do get that hugely.
And Taylor was my thing that I could love that I knew wasn't cool. But it didn't matter because, she did speak to me. And I think I did feel like I'd found something that felt like mine, and something that, you know, I always feel like a lot of her songs and lyrics were kind of permission giving.
Or, in what way?
Well, that she, I think, you know, it's interesting that I was getting into Taylor when I was at the pool, and we were, you know, all day long, we were writing about sexism, feminism, and all those conversations. And it was that era. It was Me Too. It was all those things.
We were really bang in the middle of a real movement that I now realize is dead.
It is very much dead. And actually, I think there was a backlash. But we were really, like, we were in the middle of that movement. And I think one of the things about her lyrics that spoke to me was this kind of validation and elevation of feelings which are so easily ridiculed. Often feelings about boys, you know, feelings about men, feelings about somebody you've dated for 3 months, who lots of people are going to roll their eyes and say that doesn't mean anything, or he's so clearly being a douche that what did you think was here?
There's a great many songs just dedicated to the art of loving douches.
There really is. And not only that, but sort of suggesting that your experience, however painful you may have found it, is a valid one and a true one, and they probably need to know about it, and you have every right to feel like that, and you have every right to kind of feel righteous and feel heartbroken and feel dramatic. And it just felt that, you know, it really felt that there was a kind of articulation of this period where I was just dating, you know, really subpar kind of men, one after the other. And she would just, this thing that could have so easily just been looked over, she found a way to kind of give space to and give, you know, importance to. And that felt very comforting. And I think, you know, I think that can sound, I could imagine, you know, well, so what? But actually, the validation of young women's feelings is really important.
It is.
And so overlooked and intentionally overlooked. And, you know, not only would she sort of say, yes, you know, there's a righteous anger here because you were wronged, because you entered this agreement and the other person didn't do what they said they were going to do. She completely, I think, you know, one of the things I think she does best, which I think All Too Well is about, is completely saying, no, no, no. Like, I know how this went down. I was there. You are trying to give me a narrative that I know is untrue. Mm. You are trying to paint me as some crazy young woman who's obsessive. I know, you know, there's a rejection of this common narrative that we should doubt young women and doubt their experiences. And, oh, they probably were this, they were probably that. And she absolutely defends the kind of reality, or at least the reality to you.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of, you know, it felt so honourable, and it felt so, and she does it so well. you know, she does it so well.
She's bloody good at her job.
Yeah.
Because the thing with Taylor is that, and the thing is, so you've given me a list of some of your favourite songs that you see as quintessential to your Swift fandom, and All Too Well was number one on the list. And I'm so glad it's number one on the list because it means, like, we can give it all the weight it deserves. Because I do think it is her best song, a song so good she wrote it twice, and both versions are great. But it's this thing with Taylor, and I think it is her kind of magic, where she writes sort of like quite simple toe-tappy pop songs, but within those pop songs are this real emotional specificity, but also enormous melodrama. This thing of like this weighing up of tiny little details that only you would remember if you were there, which is why people love the whole things about scarves and keychains and all that kind of gumph. But it's also just the enormity of the feeling. Yes. And you can think, you're like, oh, I'm just going to walk my dog and plop on my headphones and listen to Taylor Swift. And then you're just winded by feeling.
You are swept away somewhere. I mean, that's a really great observation. I think that's really true. And those details are really interesting because although they're so specific to her, we all have a version of it.
Yeah.
You know, that we've all got a keychain or a scarf or something, you know, that could tell this whole epic love story about the person who broke your heart. And yes, the melodrama, and she allows the melodrama the space. You know, she respects the melodrama.
Yes,
it's melodrama without being like without the kind of campness or the, you know, there's just this kind of like unapologetic. This is how I felt, and these feelings were huge. You know, and when I listened to Folklore and Evermore in lockdown, which was obviously a strange time anyway, wandering around the streets of Peckham for hours. I mean, I felt like I'd just broken up with someone I hadn't. You know, I felt like I needed to start writing poetry. I don't write poetry. You know, I just was so washed away with these incredible feelings. And yeah, she does have that. I mean, one of the great things she is, which I think that speaks to, is she's a storyteller. And that's what I like about her. You know, she will never be the world's greatest singer, vocalist. She's an incredible storyteller. She tells stories in phrases. You know, she tells stories in clever wordplay. She tells stories within stories within stories, especially in the later records. And, you know, as someone who enjoys words a lot, that is so much of the pleasure to discover more words within All Too Well, you know, phrases which was so wonderful to find even more
wordplay. And for sometimes on All Too Well, it does sound like just word association, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm good telling jokes, but the punchline. Like, what's the word that goes with jokes? Punch. All right, it sounds like almost like very slow rapping, slow freestyling.
But then I think there's more. You know, there's a line in the Taylor's version, you know, about how, you know, she's imagining the girlfriend that he would have that isn't her, who's not weeping in the bathroom, but is a jewel whose light reflects on you. You know, and that is just so smart. And I just when I heard that version of it, you go on such a journey. The lyrics, the kind of emotional journey of the music. She was what? How old the fuck? Like, was she? Like, I mean, it blows my mind that she was so self-aware and so perceptive and could write something, I think, pretty restrained that wasn't basically just fuck you.
Yeah.
You know, and was so considered. I just think her, you know, it's interesting because there is a childlike quality to Taylor's music, I think, into quite poppy, it's fun. But there's a perceptiveness which I think really belies her years. You know, there's something like Nothing New I put on my list to you, which she wrote when she wrote Red, but only released on this new version of Red.
I'd love to talk about these songs in conjunction for a little bit, because like the thing about All Too Well is that she wrote it when she was 22 and then she rewrote it when she was 32, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're supposed to sort of believe this myth that this was the original version.
Yeah, I was believing that myth.
I'm telling you why I don't believe it. So I think like All Too Well, like it's like such a sleeper anthem, right? It was an album track that just gained sort of like such an enormous support. And it was became that thing where she would sort of wink to the audience during a live show, be like, I know you want this one, which is why I've left it to the encore, the double encore or whatever. And so it became this real fan track, I think. It's how, that was sort of the mark of a real fan, was how much you cared about All Too Well in the years following Red. And it's, you know, it's like, it's this very beautiful song about what it is to end a relationship, be haunted by the memories, and not be able to almost confirm with that person that your reality was the same reality, right? And constantly going over that. And but then also with sort of reprised 10-minute long version that I believe was written recently.
Oh, don't say that.
It's this thing of like, it's revisiting that same set of memories and seeing your behavior correctly and everything, and seeing his behavior, but with the new lens of the realization of like, oh fuck, I was 22 and he was in his 30s. And that didn't seem like a big problem then, because we were both famous people and only famous people can date famous people. But now I'm starting to unfold and realize and pick away the inequality, the exploitation, the power dynamics at play. And I do think that's a set of memories that's coming, it comes for every woman eventually. Mm. Like, we all have a relationship a bit like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have to sort of analyze it in therapy or through songs or wherever. And similarly with Begin Again, it was like this very mournful song that she wrote at 22 about how she could never be 18 again. But then with the Phoebe Bridgers re-release,
Nothing New.
With Nothing New, she gets Phoebe Bridgers to join her on the new version of Red, and it's like, oh, it's like a torch passing. And Phoebe Bridgers, who is like the girl of the moment, knowing that her moment is brief, you know, it's like you're passing the torch, and the torch is already going out as in the passing, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah. No, I think it is. It's so, and all of that's happening, yet they sing so softly. I mean, yeah. Phoebe Bridgers has that voice, but Taylor's singing softly, and it's quite a kind of simple, quiet song. And, you know, in there's a lyric about kind of waking, she's waken up in the middle of the night, and this is what she thinks about. And it really feels like that kind of intimate, quiet moment where she's alone in the dark thinking shit. And then to kind of reemphasize that happening in real time with Phoebe Bridgers. But again, to have that level of self-awareness and to understand the kind of fragility of her success, because, I mean, that song is very much about being a young woman and the sexism and how she will be celebrated one minute and then she'll be over. And, you know, there's a line about, will you remember me once you've driven me out?
Yeah.
And she was so very nearly driven out.
On multiple occasions,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah. And yeah, no, it's really tender. And I think to then share that moment with the new young thing.
Yeah.
To kind of actually admit, you know, in the song, it's kind of already happened. Like, I can never be that again. And I think it's obviously very personal to Taylor and these young singer-songwriters. But actually, that's a kind of an idea, I think, more generally with it. That we have these kind of, especially as women, that we have these brief moments of when we're at our best, you know, when we're supple and young and all these things, and then it's gone, and then we're driven out because we're over 35 and nobody cares anymore. And so, yeah, I just think like to articulate that fear. I mean, it's very candid as well. I think it's very brave to sort of say, how long have I got?
And to say it at so young,
yes.
to feel so, I mean, I guess, you know, she has a different set of experiences in that I think she was on the road from like a crazy young age, so had lived a lot of life by the time she was 22. But I think there is this consistent thing with Taylor. And I remember the first time I'd ever found out who she was, I was reading a music magazine and there was an interview with her, kind of like, who is Taylor Swift kind of thing. And the music journalist was kind of saying, was interviewing her, and she was saying like, you know, oh, I'm just really hoping that I can, you know, have a relationship that can work, and I've got a crazy schedule, but I'm really hoping that, you know, to make it work with somebody or whatever. And the music director has been like, she's 19. Why is she like this, like acting like she's 37 and only has a couple of years left to have children or something, you know? This sense of like, there is this weird combination of like childlike innocence, but also 1,000 years old.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she has that. I mean, I guess that is one of the hallmarks of her being a kind of, you know, these people who are set up for it. Like, she convinced her parents to move to Nashville, yeah. didn't she? When I mean, like they were in the, I think they were in the Midwest somewhere, and she moves them to Nashville when she was about 15. And I mean, it's been a long game. I mean, she's been a professional for a long time. Yeah. And so there probably is this kind of world weariness to, you know, and again, in that Netflix documentary, there's a bit where she's saying to somebody, I can't remember who, I know my schedule for the next 2 or 3 years is planned. Like someone could tell you where I will be.
Yeah.
In 3 years time. And for somebody.
There's no way for a young woman to live.
For someone who's so clearly preoccupied with love, you know.
Yes.
And it, love is her great muse, really, isn't it? She has written about other things and sometimes very successfully, like the song about her grandmother, Marjorie, is beautiful. Mm. But really, it's her songs about relationships, which the fans love. And yet she was existing in a world for so many reasons where they were doomed, you know, because of the press, because of her schedule, because of her fame, you know. So, yeah, a really interesting thing to kind of chase, I think, as a writer, this thing that you can't actually really get a handle on.
What do you think about the whole, like, this was definitely a narrative that I think probably helped with the how defensive that the Swifties and Swift fans sort of like got, which was that the sense of, oh, Taylor Swift must be crazy because she can't hold down a man kind of thing.
I think it's really unfair because bloody hell, like if you'd seen my dating record on Hinge in, you know, a certain kind of 2 or 3 year period, I would be clinically insane, you know, by that kind of measurement. It's sexism. And I think, you know, sexism is high profile. It's like, you know, every kind of casual thing was reported in the press. So suddenly it's a boyfriend, but was it really a boyfriend or did they just kind of hang out for a few months?
Yeah.
You know, I just think there are a lot of double standards there. You know, I don't...
It's just nuts to me that we have lived through so many waves of the Taylor Swift gossip sort of rag thing. I don't know if you'll remember this. It's a very clear memory in my head. And when I think of you, it's one of the main ones.
Nervous.
But it was during that 1989 tour.
Yeah.
Where every night she had a new guest on stage and you and I had to report on it. And she was friends with Carly Kloss and a Jenner probably.
Yeah.
And the Hadids and all these just
everyone.
Like the leggiest women in show business, the leggiest young women.
And also Bryan Adams, I seem to remember.
And like Joan Baez.
That was way more interesting to me. But yeah
and,
I remember.
And this had, because the 1989 tour went on for so long. And that is when I got involved with Taylor, actually. There was that album. I totally fell in love with it and have been a Swiftie ever since. But it was a tour that went on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And the sort of endless pap shots of Taylor linking arms
with the girl squad.
Yes, the girl squad going into VIP areas. I remember one day you closing your MacBook and you just said, I'm done with Taylor. I can't do it anymore. I can't do this sort of like weird girl squad thing. Do you remember that
day? Yeah, I had a few of those moments. You know, I definitely had a few of those moments. There was the squad. There was when she sued, or her people sued.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A blogger who had about 200 followers on Twitter.
There's pops off at random people sometimes.
You know, to get her lawyer, you know, you could imagine her team of lawyers, probably 20 of them or something, going after some, you know. But so, there has definitely been some moments. And the squad was, I always actually felt really cringy about the squad because it was clearly like somebody who'd never been popular at school was finally popular.
Yeah.
And it just, it was so unnecessary. It's like, you're so famous and rich and we believe you have friends. Like, we believe you. Like, I'm sure you know famous people. And yeah, it was the worst version of what, of that moment we were in, was that female empowerment was just women walking together towards a camera.
Women acquiring capital.
Yeah,
is
right.
Feminism.
Right. Individual women getting rich and then looking, you know, completely unreal and all walking together in slow motion was meant to kind of surmise this moment of a new, you know, wave of feminism. And I just hated it. I hated every inch of it. It was all so false and it was all so meaningless and it was counter to what I felt at the time were actually very important conversations. And it was just like, no, because the tailor had fallen in love with was the red tailor who I saw when I saw her on her red tour in London. She had on like an Abbey Road t-shirt and denim shorts and flat shoes and just really looked like she could have been in the audience.
Yeah.
And then she kind of morphed into this like pop star, like Wonder Woman type thing. And, you know, I didn't like it.
I don't think you were alone in that, actually. I do remember this prickle of backlash happening around then. And I do understand it because it's the sense of like all these women what's sweet as well is that when Red came out, if we think of millennial women, we all would have been in our early 20s kind of thing, which is generally when you have your first huge breakup.
Mm-hmm.
And millions of women survived that breakup with Red jammed in their ears and pretending that they were walking through an autumn forest with their best friend Taylor, who's only their friend. And then suddenly to have that same friend seem like Regina George, just like stomping around with the Hadids, was like, no, you've forgotten me.
Exactly. It felt a little bit of a betrayal of who you thought you were as a Taylor fan.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
She made no kind of secret of being a bit of an outsider. I mean,
As much as a tall blonde woman.
Exactly. But not really feeling like she had, you know, being a bit of a outsider at school and feeling a bit different from others, again, as much as she is possible. And then but that's what I mean. It was like she'd seemed to like, oh, I found a way to hang out with the cool girls. And now I'm going to forget all of you losers. And I'm just going to like hang over here with Cara Delevingne. And it just felt really disappointing. And, it, you know, again, it was like, oh, Taylor's being uncool again. You know, please, Taylor, just be naturally uncool and then I like you. But this kind of forced, you know, it just all felt very...
Like the me video.
Yeah.
That was hard to take, wasn't it? That was a rough toke.
And there are these moments. And, there's part of me, I guess, that applauds her for moving her music on and trying to write a different kind of thing. And... all of that stuff. But that was definitely a moment like, oh, no, what are you doing? And like, I can't follow you here.
Yeah.
You know, I can't go here.
I can buy a Baker Boy hat and a scarf, but I can't do this.
I cannot do this. And it just felt a bit silly and unnecessary. And I think, you know, again, when she was suing that blogger, I was like, you pretend that you're like everyone else with your baking, but you are a multimillionaire. Why are you suing somebody who probably earns less than, you know, $20,000 a year? It's just distasteful and inappropriate. And actually, she was getting sued because they'd written this whole, which is a bit far-fetched, this whole post about how 1989 was full of alt-right references.
I remember that this is another moment in the Taylor discourse when she's secretly an
she's
Aryan.
She's a secret Nazi. And, yeah. and in one of her videos, she was wearing leather, which they said was like Hitler.
I mean, absolutely nuts.
It was clearly nuts. But then it was like, well, she still wasn't really saying anything at this point. So instead of suing this individual,
yeah,
she could have just said, instead of being silent, she could have just kind of made her opinions on things that are really not that controversial.
So
no.
Just, I am not a Nazi.
I'm not a Nazi. I'm not an alt-right, you know, I'm not a, you know, racist. I'm not these things.
I remember this moment of the discourse very well because, like, I remember it was like all these sort of Jezebel, and we probably reported on it too because nothing was beneath us. Truly. You could probably sense that me and Marisa have, like, fairly checkered memories of our feminist media past. But it was like, okay, there's like this whole sort of alt-right movement online that has begun to idolize Taylor Swift because of her sort of blonde Germanic looks or whatever. And that's creepy, sure. Yeah. And because she's from the South and all these reasons. And we reported on that. We and people like us reported on that. And then the story kind of didn't go anywhere. So then people started demanding, well, why hasn't Taylor said anything? And it's like, well, yeah. Is it her job?
I mean, absolutely. But then the suing just felt like a completely...
No, that was a mad reaction.
Reaction. Like, yeah. It's not her job. Of course, like, if you're that famous, you cannot possibly be expected to defend yourself against, you know, especially those corners of the internet, which are so dogged and so extreme and so ridiculous. And you just want to stay as far away as possible, but the army of lawyers, I really remember just being like, no, I can't do this. But again, I think she's definitely moved away from those moments, you know, as she's got older, and actually as I've got older, I'm much more forgiving towards her,
and I expect less from her.
I expect much less. Yes.
That's the main lesson of female celebrity, I think. It's like, when I think of all those people like Taylor Swift and Lena Dunham and all these people, it's like, we expected so much from women in their mid-20s.
Yeah, I mean, what did they owe us?
What? Nothing! They were making this wonderful art that was for and about us, and we just spat in their faces.
I know. And I mean, that we do that with any, you know, we put these people on the pedestals, don't we? And then we throw rocks at the pedestals. I don't know what I expected from her. I don't know why I felt she should do better by me. Like, you
know.
That's
the thing. It's the whole thing of the parasocial relationship. When you tell your fans sort of intricate details about your personal life and give them songs about it and you make them feel like you are a family.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like, yeah, and also when you're a fan, which is your choice, but you've invested so many hours.
Totally your choice.
You've invested so many hours listening to this woman, and you begin to trust her this weird way. And then she does something that you really object to, and you're like, hang on a minute. You know, I'm not very good at separating art from artists. I mean, that's a much bigger conversation. And you know, but, and I also, sometimes, you know, I was thinking about this on the way. Taylor's crimes, of which she's apologized, you know, I feel like she's been criticized for this and this and this and this and this and this. You know, none of them are criminal. None of them are violent. She's never even, like, drunkenly fallen out of a car, you know?
It's always like, behaving a bit bizarrely.
It is. Like, she hasn't ever done anything unspeakably awful.
And yet there was years there.
And yet you still have this, like, oh, can I, you know, should I show my allegiance with her, because what does that say about me? And actually I was thinking, well, was she ever really, you know, like Lena Dunham, for example, was famously like had to apologize something.
Yeah.
There's whole lists on the internet of the time she's had to apologize for ridiculous things and offensive things she said. And I think there was the Shake It Off video, Taylor had to apologize for racial stereotyping some of the dancers. But, you know, and she did apologize, and I just, you know, I mean, I hate to sound like the pool circa 2017, but, you know, compare her crimes.
Mel Gibson is still making films.
Yeah, well.
Mel Gibson is still making films.
Where do you want to start? We
could
just list them. Them all.
But do you know what we should get back into instead? The music. Because we haven't talked about that in a while. Well, the next songs I would like to talk about on your list is a toozy, which is the Archer and Mirrorball. Because I think they're companion pieces.
Oh, interesting. Tell me why.
My favorite of the sort of latest Taylor era, kind of lover, like things like the pandemic has done things to Taylor as it has done things to us. And I think sort of lover onwards, we're seeing a lot of self-reflection on what it is to be this global megastar. And the thing about both of them, both songs, is this sense of, I have been playing the part of Taylor Swift for so long that I don't know how to be a human being, and I'm afraid that has made me unlovable. Like, this is the cost of being an overachiever kind of thing. And it really gets me.
Yeah, you look like you might be welling up.
It really gets me.
Yes. Well, she's, as part of her skill, I think, as a writer, is her vulnerability. Her, you know, you really feel her feelings, and then you feel all your own feelings. And yeah, the line in The Archer is, "Who could ever leave me, but who could ever stay?"
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it's crushing, isn't it? It's absolutely crushing. And
all of my heroes, the dial alone.
Yeah. It is this haunting, you know, and she wakes up again. It's in the middle of the night, isn't there? And she's seeing ghosts. And yeah, there's this haunting. She's being haunted by her fear of being alone. And I think, you know, Mirrorball is not that feeling so much, but this, like, I'm constantly performing. Constantly performing for my fans, for you. I'm constantly trying to make people love me. And what happens when the circus goes home and it's just me? And yeah, I think...
I find it very moving.
It is really moving.
Because I feel like I... this is the thing. These songs I relate to more because I feel like, as someone who fills their days with trying to put as much podcasts and novels into them as possible, I'm like, oh, does anyone like me yet? kind of thing. And that the line that always gets me, and I have a bit of an episode when I'm writing, when I'm walking the dog listening to it, is she says, when no one is around, my dear, you'll find me on my tallest tiptoes and my highest heels. And that thing of, like, she doesn't know how to switch it off anymore. Like, why, when she's by herself, she's still, like, tiptoes, high heels. Do you know what I mean? And I find that really relatable. Like, sometimes I don't know when I'm doing a bit.
Yeah, well, I think it's the price of ambition, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the price of following your dreams, you know? And it's she's so good at what she does, but what is the cost of that? And the loneliness of being that kind of special, I guess, in terms of, you know, that famous and that, you know, there's only one Taylor Swift, and that there's a loneliness in those songs, which is really sad.
And it is this thing, it's very sad but narratively very satisfying, of this thing of, we've watched her for so long, of like this sort of breakout country star who pursues this level of pop stardom that had, like, reached this ascendancy point during 1989, and then Reputation obviously was like, I'm bad now kind of thing. But it was kind of the same thing. It was like, I'm a pop star who does, like, choreographed dance and huge live shows, and it's not just me and my guitar anymore. And she was obviously off like a rocket towards something. She had some point in her own head, she must have had, of what she was looking to achieve, and now she's on the other side of it, on the climb down of being like, oh, she has everything in the world, and it's lonely and sad. But and she has to convince Jo Alwyn that she's normal.
Which I think looks like she has.
Yeah.
Looks like she has. But I also found in particularly The Archer, actually something relatable, not in, you know, the feeling that, like, you know, it's lonely at the top. But in that feeling of, because in those years, in those dating years, I felt pretty unlovable, which I think a lot of women do, a lot of people do, until you find somebody who you click with. And I would just be going on these dates and I'd just be like, I'd be like, fuck, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And yet, if you are a certain age, you know, at least I was brought up, you know, by this very, you know, proud single mum who was like, you're the best. Anyone is lucky to have you.
Yeah.
And yet I'd go into the world and I I just feel like I've got nothing to say to these people. They don't seem to understand me. They don't get my humor. They don't get my passion. They don't get... And I really felt that, like, well, hang on, why aren't you here? But then why... But why would you be here?
Oh.
And I really felt that. And I think that's what has kept me, my fandom, is that there's always a lyric where I'm like, yes, that is it. That is how
that
I
is
feel.
It, yeah.
And I think, you know, for her, that it, I think you're right. Those songs are about her career. But I actually think that's relatable. Again, you know, I think it's the... And I don't know if that's intentional. I just think often with great stories, they are told specifically to the person telling them, but the way in which they are told, we can all find something in them.
Mm.
And I think that's so true to me, is that, you know, and I think there will always be a part of that that me that feels like that disconnect. You know, I have these qualities, but then I don't have these qualities, and where does that leave me? And yeah, that song, I remember when that, I was working, I was like doing shifts, freelance shifts in an office, and it was bored as fuck, and I was like, and I just went in, I just played that song over and over, like,
Archer.
Just all day. I mean, I didn't do anything else. And then I think, you know, again, like one of the other, it's really nice to put these songs together, because the thing she does really well is her imagery.
Yeah.
And the imagery in that, and then in Mirable, is just beautiful. You know, it's so beautiful how she captures those moments.
And like, dreamy while being very grounded at the same time. Like, you can definitely see an entire scene.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. It's amazing how she can do these, like, quite abstract, very pictorial things while still having it grounded in absolute feeling, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I've been the archer, I've been the prey. And you're kind of in the sort of like Katniss Everdeen sort of a world, but
yeah,
you still totally get it, you know?
Yes, exactly. There's something so inclusive about like how she is singing about being a world famous pop star, and yet we both are like, we so relate.
Like, me and my podcast, I understand.
Yeah.
It's the same, Taylor. Another song you included that's one of my absolute favourites is Out of the Woods. What made you choose it?
One of the reasons I chose it is because I remember just listening to it and being like, oh, Taylor, where are we going?
Who are you
now? Yeah, like, yeah. What's happened? And being really excited by it, but like, oh, you know, just thinking, instantly thinking it was awesome and very cool and fun, but just different. Mm. And the urgency in it, you know, that panic, you know, that panic again.
It's the delivery, isn't it?
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah. The panic, like, when is this going to be okay? Like, I mean, I've had women talk to me about that feeling for hours, you know, like, you know, that kind of, does this mean this? Does this mean this? When's he going to message? He hasn't messaged. Like, that, like, where are, like, oh, you know, are we out of the woods? It was just that feeling that she, you know, put into this kind of frenetic, like, 3-minute pop song. And then this kind of move away in a way that I felt was, of, you know, poppy and bold, but felt to me kind of just all of her, like, great storytelling, the feeling, you know, it didn't feel too generic or kind of, I don't know, like some of her other big poppy songs.
I remember the summer of 1989, and particularly that song, which I think was the lead single, coming out. It really did feel like the summer of Taylor. And it felt like that album was everywhere. That is so rare, because with Spotify and everything, it's just incredibly rare that you have everyone listening to the same thing at once.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those moments where everybody loved it. And like, I was still working in advertising and having that album on every Friday night, and I was sort of falling in love with Gav at the same time. Mm. And it was that kind of rocky beginning of the relationship where you're drinking a lot and you're shagging a lot, but you're also fighting a lot. And thinking that every fight is going to break new ground and break new territory and put you in a new place. And that sort of, oh, yeah, there was that. Like, it is like, it's a hyperventilation of a song of like trying to convince yourself that you've found a new, clear and simple place with a partner. And I mean, it worked for me, but for most people, it doesn't.
No,
you know?
And I think, you know, in the song, there are these moments that she clings to, you know. You know, when he's in the hospital, or the you know, when they push the sofas and dance. And, you know, and they're tiny moments. And that's what you do when you're in a situation which is so insecure and so undefined and ultimately so unpleasant, you latch onto these tiny moments where you can say, no, but look.
We had real clarity.
This is
there.
A thing. This yeah. is a thing. And so, you know, and you exist, you know, you kind of think, oh, no, this is okay because of this. And you persuade yourself. And yeah, she just encapsulated that. And, you know, I've known it. I've known so many women who've known it. Like, there it was, and in this kind of new sound, I was just like, yes.
It should be the anthem of women in relationships who have allowed polyamory for a short time.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the dating.
This will fix it.
Yeah, like one of the dating apps should have it as like when you open up the app, it should just like start playing because that's the general vibe. Yeah, incredible. And then actually it's my gym song. Like I always
really?
Go, yeah, a lot of them are my gym. I mean, she's my every song, like my every occasion. But yeah, I just know that if I put that song on, like I'm, cuz I can skip a Taylor track, you know.
Oh yeah. Oh, we all can.
Yeah. But not that one.
That song she did with the Haim sisters, that's a skip for me. That's a hard skip.
You shouldn't always work with your friends. I mean,
no, and I love the Haim sisters.
Yeah, so do I. Oh yeah, there is some misses, but that's okay. You know,
yeah,
that's okay.
Another inclusion I was surprised by on your list was "Getaway Car," the only song from the Reputation album.
Yeah,
the Reputation era was a strange moment.
It was, and she kind of, I think she alludes to that, doesn't she, a little bit.
I feel like she knows.
Yeah, and it, you know, she had to get that shit out, you know, and she did, got it off her chest, and she did it. I think that's a great, I think it has similar energy, and it's a great story. Like, I love how she's kind of taken a misguided fling and, you know, has got all the kind of imagery of a motel and a getaway bag.
And story,
and I love how she does it live, where kind of she introduces it with this film of a car kind of going across the desert. And she just turns this like flippant kind of mistake into this kind of movie, you know, and there's a lovely, lovely pace. And yeah, I love the drama of it. I love the drama. And I love kind of how she takes something that could be a mistake and actually kind of says, no, it's okay because there's a story there, you know? And I think that's quite comforting.
That's,
you know, like,
it.
You know, like we've done these things, but they're stories that we'll take with us, and they tell us something about ourselves, and we've learned something from it. And, you know, yeah, I just thought it was also so cinematic. I just thought it was cool.
I love it. There's some real spots where I really enjoy that album. Not a lot.
Yeah, moments. Not, there's some really bad songs on that record.
That Endgame song.
Yeah.
It's a she's veered too far into a territory that doesn't belong to her. It's like, give that to Little Mix. Yeah. That is a fine song for Little Mix to sing.
Yeah, and you know, she is a writer, isn't she, for other people. So
yeah,
I feel like they probably were like, okay, Taylor, you know, Taylor needs to do what Taylor needs to do right now.
What I do love about that era though is the sheer extraness of it, because there was that fabulous day to be online when she had talked about Kanye West and that whole moment or whatever, and about how he called her out in a song saying, I made that bitch famous, and then she accepted an award saying, if people try and blah blah blah, fuck Kanye West kind of thing. And then Kim Kardashian West released a video of her leaving a voicemail saying to Kanye, thank you for the flowers or whatever. And this like blew up the internet, not because it was a good story particularly, but because of the fame of all three people involved just like boiled over everything. And then she wrote an entire album in response.
Yeah, I mean, she's really, I mean, like what she did to Jake Gyllenhaal. I mean, you know, yes, I think actually probably what Taylor has done most successfully is hidden the fact probably about how strategic she has been about brand Taylor. And that has been a very concerted effort from day one. And along comes two of the world's most famous people and says, no. Yeah. All that stuff is bullshit. She's a liar. And, you know, because that's what Kim Kardashian was calling her, a liar.
Yeah.
Which seemingly then another thing was released like more recently and she wasn't lying.
Oh, yeah, Taylor was like, where did I say it was okay to call me a bitch in your song? Yeah. Which, fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of understand if you are that, if you're that famous, you're probably exceptionally concerned and in control of how the world perceives you.
And which is something she's had great fun with as well. Like, songs like Blank Space and the videos that go with it are just fabulous.
She totally does. And she sees the injustice of it and she plays with that. But she recognises that. And then there was this perception and she'd gone from Golden Girl to, you know, this kind of... I mean, people only ever ask me to talk about Taylor Swift. Like, I was asked on, I remember I was in Soho having drinks with friends and I was asked to go on Radio 4.
Oh my gosh.
On a night, like a 10 p.m. news program to talk about the fact Taylor Swift had allowed Instagram to turn off her comments.
Oh, I do remember that. It is mad how much we know.
Because she was being flooded with snake emojis.
It isn't exactly like racial bile, is it?
So she went from, Golden Girl to this hated, you know, she says something like, you know, people don't understand what it's like to have millions of people around the world effectively tell you to kill yourself. And so I can understand that the response to Kanye was going to be big. You know, I don't think you become that famous and then feel kind of okay when someone like basically makes a mockery of you and tries to claim your success and, you know, is misogynistic and calls you a liar. But yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know. Did she,
I didn't ask you to come on here to defend her.
No. And ultimately, like what, like Kanye was much older than her when he went on stage and, you know, like it's an embarrassing move on his part, I think, and an embarrassing move on, like...
Embarrassing, but I think we're all glad it happened. Like, it's a defining moment for pop culture.
It was a massive moment for pop culture. And apparently Taylor has actually got a picture of the moment he interrupted her.
Oh, really?
In her house, next to the award.
I find that very cool.
And with this quote, which again... apparently is in one of the album sleeves somewhere, which is life is full of little interruptions. I mean, you know.
I do like that.
Yeah.
It's a bit lame, but kind of cool, but kind of lame.
I mean, whatever she needs to do. I think like the fact that she didn't, I think the lesson really is that Reputation is one of her weaker albums. And therefore, while it might have made her feel better, she should focus on other things.
It's not as if she waits 5 years to put an album out. Like, there's one coming down the pipe, you know? If you don't like this one, try Lover. It's coming very soon.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. God, if I was 19 and I was in that position, I don't know what I would do. And I think Kanye was a total jerk. But yeah, the drama and to be tabloid gossip like that. And, you know, she said, famously, she said she didn't want to be part of that narrative. But I think fame at that level, you have to sacrifice something. You cannot control unless you're Dolly Parton. But even Dolly, you know, Dolly Parton was an absolute joke, really, until about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I've just got a feeling she's a massive control freak, and I imagine not being able to control the narrative when she'd spent so many years firmly sticking to the script and absolutely kind of doing what she thought she should, and then someone comes along and trashes that and she has nothing she can do. I imagine that was pretty torturous for someone like her. I say this as if I have any idea.
We've got a couple songs on your list left. Would you like to talk about Lover first or August, which I both thought were... you know, they were out of the box choices.
Oh, interesting.
August, I find, was the most out of the box choice because it was one of my skipovers.
Was it?
So I'm interested in why it's not one of yours.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a Jack Antonoff one, I think. Is that how I say his name? Antonoff.
Oh, yeah.
I love the chorus. I just love it. Yeah, it's that kind of, you know, again, it was Taylor. It's only ever bad news, but it's the heartbreak. And there's a wonderful line about how she's obviously staring at this boy on the beach and she wants to write her name on his back. And I mean, it's just, and that she's obviously young and it's a kind of really early kind of sexual kind of like ownership thing. I just,
I never actually got that from the song. Okay, now I like it again.
Yeah, and the kind of twisted bed sheets that and that kind of.
It's a real earworm.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a just, oh, I just love, mostly I just love the sound of it. Yeah, I think, yeah, why do I love that one so much? It's very feel good.
Yeah.
It's very, very feel good. And
On Folklore, I believe.
Yes, yes. And Lover, I just, you know, I just think she wrote it entirely on her own. You know, one of the few on the track, on the record where she's got the only writing credit.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And I mean, she gets a lot of shit about the line, "We can take the Christmas lights down in January."
It is a bit.
Which is a bit peculiar.
Just when most people take them down.
Yeah. But it's this really simple love song. I think there's a kind of like the guitar and it almost sounds very cool. It doesn't quite.
Yeah, that's
but it
true.
Almost sounds like, there's almost like, it made me think of something like Chrissy Hynde or some, you know, there was some kind of, it sounded of a slightly different genre. I just thought it was what a song to write. Like, how do you write a really romantic love song that doesn't sound ridiculous?
This is it. So she's reaching this place now in her career where she seems like, for all intents and purposes, very happily, domestically in love. And it seems that she's very intent on keeping that relationship private. It seems that she's figured out that one of the common things that have ended relationships is the public, right? So it seems like she's really paying for that good security so her and Joe can be on an island.
Yeah, pretty much.
But how do you still write autobiographically and write gripping songs that people relate to?
Yeah.
And when it's basically just a love song. And I think she really did that on Lover. And
she
I loved that album.
Yeah, she did. I think she did. I think, you know, there was a feeling that, like, you know, all of her problems are solved with one man.
Yeah. I don't think that.
But yeah, I think especially with Lover, I think there was just this very, again, it felt very honest. It felt like she was letting us into this thing that was very, very private as well. I think that's probably the closest we're going to get. And I think I totally understand her, the fact that you never see them together.
I think she does pay for it to be that way.
Yeah, you know yeah. I think, yeah. But I think, yeah, like, you know, that's the worry, isn't it, as a Taylor Swift fan? Like, if she's just content
Where's the material?
And where's the material? And that was so interesting about Folklore and Evermore, was that this foray into, you know, making things up, basically.
Some of which I loved. Mm-hmm. Like, her story songs, when they're good, they're great. Mm-hmm. Like, I love The Last Great American Dynasty.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing song.
I remember my whole group of friends, we just lost our minds with, and then it was bought by her.
Yeah, I know. The first time you hear it.
You're like,
the
literally.
The first time you hear it.
You're like one of those NASA technicians who just takes down their earphones like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And that I love. Yeah. And then there's like songs like Nobody, No Crime. And I'm like, this feels like something you'd write at GCSE. Yeah. A bit.
Or kind of like, you know, how to write a song. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them worked. Some of them didn't. And some of the stories, you know, I liked how she played with the different perspectives because they're all love stories, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're all infidelity or...
But I do love that, like, because the co-writing credits on those albums are all like the guys from The National and Bon Iver and that kind of stuff. It's like, feels like all these like middle-aged men who are now very bored of their own credibility. They're like, I just want to go to Taylor Swift summer camp and make daisy chains and talk about crushes.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a lovely holiday for them.
And also make a shit ton of money, right?
Make a shit ton of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, I am sure people are cynical, you know, because obviously you write a big song with Taylor and you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's really interesting, I think, that move into that particular genre of middle-aged man.
Her patronising incredibly famous men, yeah. I find very cool.
Yeah, so do I. So do I. And, you know, she kind of, like, they've got a band together, the guy from The National and Bon Iver called Oh, now I've forgotten.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Big Red something.
Oh, and, yes. Yeah, I've listened. I like it, I think.
Yeah, and they... And she then, like, features on their record. And there's just this kind of nice hanging out that, you know, I think she just seems to have found a tribe. And weirdly, you know, a kind of... For people searching for Taylor to be cool, at one time, those people were very cool. I mean, they're not as cool as they were. But it's interesting to me that that's kind of where she is now, with these kind of, like... indie-ish male
guys much
guitar.
Older than her.
Yeah. And they're still kind of singing Taylor, as you say, like crushes and, you know, how do I feel about this thing again? So yeah, it's really fascinating. But you know, I'm like, the guy from The National described writing songs with Taylor like dancing with Fred Astaire. And
wow.
I just
that's a big thing for someone from The National to say. Do you know what I mean? Like that, like that's just the ultimate figurehead of like what it like is to be like a cool music guy. But maybe not anymore because they're such a huge band now. But yeah. Certainly for a long time, it was like, you know, MrPitchfork.com, right?
Yeah. Which I think her credibility seems to be on the up in some ways. I mean, it's I think we spoke about this before, but you know, Billy Joel compared her to the Beatles, which I don't actually think is true.
In terms of volume, it might be.
But in terms of volume, I think it's true. In terms of kind of influence, and you know, I don't think it's true. But there does seem to be a growing credibility around her, and I do wonder how much that is since she's kind of come out and said, "No, I'm not a Nazi." And
I think it's the her living a quiet life thing, which makes me a little bit sad because it means like, okay, so in order for women to be respected artists, do they also have to live small enough for you to fit them in
your
head?
Yeah, I think she, yes, I think that's, I mean, that's been the dilemma with her all along, hasn't it? I guess her trying to fit into a way that she thinks the world finds her acceptable, and then the world responding.
What's the next phase of Taylor that you'd like?
I mean,
like she's had so many movements and aesthetics and sounds. Yeah, like, what would you love next?
I'm not a diehard fan enough to be that excited by all the re-recording. You know, like
yes,
Red was the big one. The rest can come.
Red gave us a lot. I think
Red gave us a lot. I mean, I was reading something about somebody reckons there'll be a bunch of new tracks on 1989. I don't know. I mean, I could do like a whole another folklore. I don't know. I want to be surprised again. I think that's why Out of the Woods was on that my list, because that joy of being like, oh, and I think, you know, I really enjoy her collaborations. You know, I'd love to read something that she'd written that wasn't for a song.
You know, I'd like love some to prose?
Yeah, or like a script, because you know, like we've said, so many of her films, songs seem so cinematic to me.
Having said that, that All Too Well video absolutely
not.
Made me gack. Like,
well, I was kind of okay with it until the bit in the bookshop. I found the bit in the bookshop
in the
really,
red wig.
Yeah,
I'm
really
acting.
Awful. Really awful.
Do you know what I'd love next, personally? I'd love and maybe she's done this already in a way, kind of with Red, but a real like Taylor Swift in the E Street Band kind of moment. Like imagine like Taylor Swift doing a song like Rosalita and just like giving it real throat on stage, you know?
Yeah, which she hasn't done enough of, have she?
Yeah.
Really?
Like full band, big orchestra music. Like, it's like, right, Taylor's coming back to the live stage or whatever, post-pandemic, we're free again.
With a
huge band. Yeah.
Yes, I would definitely prefer a huge band to all the dancers and the giant snake. That's for sure.
Yeah. And like per proper, like sweating it out in a leotard. Just like sweat down the back.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, because she does really give it.
Yeah.
When she performs. I mean, it's she.
Yeah, I don't need you to dance, Taylor.
Stay still.
Or just like do, like, that's something I really love about Miley Cyrus is that I think she's left that part of her career behind and she just really just, the performance is just her giving it on stage.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think, I mean, sounds awful, but Taylor's best work, I would guess, is when Taylor is just content being Taylor. Like when she's tried to go off and do other things, I feel like it hasn't really worked so much.
Yeah.
You know, she recorded Folklore and Evermore in lockdown as a kind of seemingly like, oh, let's kill the time.
Mm.
So I just, I don't know.
Kind of her best received work in years,
yeah,
isn't it, really?
Yeah. I just kind of want her to kind of a little bit do, I mean, a bit contradictory to what I said. I like to be surprised, but I also like Taylor to do what she's good at. You know, stick to what she's really good at. You know, I don't know. I think actually, contradictorily, the world could do with a little bit of a Taylor break.
Oh.
Yeah, as a fan, I could, you know.
You really want a chance to miss her and then have like a whole bank of 20 new songs to obsess over.
Yeah, I want to miss her.
Rather than dribs and drabs of like, here's a bonus track for such and such.
Yeah, I want to miss her. I want her to have some time away. I want her to come back a bit different, maybe with different hair. You know, maybe she's discovered some new genre of music or writer or something. You know, I think I want her to go off and live a bit. And
I'd be interested in a novel by Taylor or a novella.
A novella. Yeah, I reckon it's in her. It's probably there, isn't it? It's probably
there.
Yeah,
it's sitting around. Yeah, I'm
sure it is. She's like frighteningly productive. But I think we could probably do with a Taylor break. And, you know, fuck me. She's not yet 35. She's got time, hasn't she?
Yeah, fucking hell. We're going to get like at least another 30 years, Taylor.
I know. I know. And sometimes I like to imagine what she'll be like when she's sort of, you know, 70. Like, will she just still be with her guitar and her cookies, you know? Or will she like still knocking out music? Will she be like Paul McCartney, just constantly at it?
Oh, I wouldn't like that. I'd like her to be like a Joni Mitchell, really.
Yeah. Maybe. She loves Paul McCartney, though, doesn't she?
She does. I remember, we should wrap up, but there was some, a few years ago, Taylor was supposed to be doing a show in June and the tickets had been released to buy in December and they were incredibly expensive. And I was going to go with my friend Aisling and she said, but it's in June and what if we're mad at her then?
That's amazing.
I was like, that's the Taylor experience.
That's it.
What if we're mad at her then?
That's it. And again, it's that kind of personal, like, what if we've fallen out with our friend Taylor?
So nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask a very Desert Island Disc question.
Okay.
You can only listen to one of these songs forever.
Oh my God. Well, All Too Well, the 10-minute version.
That's it. You want bang for your buck, don't
you?
Yeah,
it has to be. It has to be. It has to be. And then maybe one day she'll release a 20-minute version.
And Jake Gyllenhaal will be gunned down at his local Whole Foods. I have to say, not much I admire about Jake Gyllenhaal, but I really admire him just keeping shtum.
Oh, yeah. And, he even went on, you know, Saturday Night Live recently.
I was waiting for the moment.
Yeah, and he just, yeah. I mean, I love the fact that his current girlfriend is about 24 or something. That is amazing. I mean, he's an exceptionally handsome man. There are worse people to be your douchebag ex, you know?
Yeah.
Like that, but yeah, he...
Some of us have douchebag exes and they're not famous.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Or handsome.
Like, I know, and no one cares when we talk about them.
Exactly. And I mean, I really didn't... He kind of... I think he said something in an interview about how it's not great for other people's fans to abuse other people or something. And I just thought, there's zero sympathy for you here, mate. Like, zero. Yeah. Like, you're just being painted as a heartthrob. Like... You know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really understand.
Yeah, she's not even really accusing him of anything specifically other than just being negligent, which is just, hello, men.
Yeah. There are so many worse things that he could have done. So, yeah, I have no sympathy for him. But yes, I think you're right that he has just...
I have sympathy for Taylor Lautner, the co-star of Twilight, who she briefly dated and who has nowhere to be seen for years. Yeah. What did she do to him?
What did she do to him in that big house she had on Rhode Island?
Yeah, only one could live. We better wrap up, but you are writing a book at the moment.
I am.
Does
I'm trying
have a title
to.
Or it, a release
it,
date?
It doesn't have. It doesn't have a title, and it's meant to be released in 2023.
Okay.
So it's very much a work in progress. If Taylor would have written this book about 7 years ago and be on like the or rewriting it now, she would be. But yeah, I'm a bit slower.
But you can be found at Marissa J. Bate.
Yes,
correct?
That's my Twitter handle. That's a good memory.
I know.
Very good.
I used to be the social media editor, so I have everyone's Twitter handles on
scored
lock.
Your brain.
Yeah, is there anything else you'd like to plug while we're here?
And I guess I should. I have a newsletter.
Oh, yes.
And it's called Writing About Women, which pretty much does what it says. bit more rambling sometimes, my own thoughts. Not many Taylor references.
Still good.
Well, yes, hopefully. But yes, it's free and you don't even have to sign up because I just put it on the internet every 3 weeks.
Oh.
But that's where you can find it.
Well, thank you, Marisa Bate.
Thank you, Carolina Donahoe. Yeah, well, what an honor. What a huge honor. I would like to kind of apologize, disclaimer, to the fans that will be outraged.
What you missed. How dare
yeah,
you.
What I missed. Yeah, exactly. But
you really
yeah.
came for the love story years.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris, and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com, or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram at Zaraline.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.